you.
Thank you.
Hi. My name's Sue. I'm an addict. Whoa. This is kind of scary. Okay, I can do this. Because I got help. I'm not doing it by myself. All right. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Oh my gosh. Story of my life. It's a real crazy saga. I'm the oldest of six kids. I grew up pretty much overseas. My dad sold tractors. He was what they called a field representative for Caterpillar Tractor. So we would live in one country and he'd travel in a bunch of countries around there and sell tractors, and then we'd move. And by the time I was 11 years old, I'd lived in 11 countries, or at least I'd been in 11 countries, not actually lived in it that many for that long. There were responsibilities with being an American in our family, because our dad always said, oh, how you behave, what you do and what you say represents the United States. Is that huge for a kid? Yeah. So I was always conscious of sitting up straight, not putting my elbows on the table, not speaking unless I was spoken to by adults. Just a lot of restrictions that most kids don't have to live up to. My dad drank every day. I didn't know he was alcoholic. I just thought that's what grown-ups do. And so, well, actually, by the time I was probably 8 or 9, I was having wine with dinner, because you should be able to drink like a lady. So we'd have a little wine with our meal. I didn't get drunk until I was 12 years old. And then I didn't even realize I was drunk. Except I was following my cousins. We were at a family reunion in Wisconsin, and we were out in the country, and I had been bringing pitchers of beer to the adults at the tables and sipping the foam, and I didn't think I was drinking. And then when we were running towards this lake, I kept sliding off the path and falling down. My dad knew what was going on. He came and got me and said, you have to take a nap. Oh, was I mad. A nap. Okay. Well, at 16, I came to the States and spent a semester at Messmer High School, because I had graduated high school in New Zealand and couldn't enter an American university until I had American history and civics. So I took a couple classes at Messmer. And of course I didn't fit in. Who fits in when they come into a high school your senior year, second semester? Yeah. It was just so different here. One of the things that just blew me away was how people treated each other. People. There were two African-American kids in all of Messmer High School in 1962. Only two. And our country made me feel really ashamed of being American. You know, just how we treated each other, how people treated each other, the names they called each other when they didn't even know people. It was pretty heavy. So I went to college at 17 and I drank every night. Parties, frat parties, beer parties, any kind of parties. I got pregnant at 18 and married. Because in those days, You didn't keep your baby, and if you weren't married, at least it never happened in our family. And I wasn't giving my baby away, so I got married. Big mistake. I wasn't ready, he wasn't ready. And we had two kids together, and I stuck it out 9.5 years. And then we split up. By then, I had found marijuana. Ooh, I didn't give me a hangover. All my new friends, as a divorced woman, I went back to school as soon as I broke up with my first husband and got into all kinds of things like, I don't know, there were marches, there were demonstrations. People were really political. And I really thought we could change the world. And I worked for George McGovern in 1968. And when they blew him out of the water by calling his running mate or his vice president crazy because he had seen a psychologist for depression, that was the end of my political involvement. I just realized it was a big lie. So I drank and I smoked. And I got together with the man I'm married to today, who was at that time very much into drinking and drugging. And we hooked up and we got married. We were party partners. We had two more kids together, so then we had four kids. And I stayed home. I was lucky enough to be a stay-at-home mom. I didn't know I wasn't normal. You know, I used any substance that came our way just because it was there. And I think I must have been around 30 when I first was introduced to cocaine. I liked it. I didn't feel shy. I didn't feel like I wasn't as smart as you or as pretty as you or, you know, as in the know. I just felt like, oh, now I can talk. I'm not shy anymore. How cool is that? Yeah. When I was a young girl, I was raised in Catholic schools all the way through high school. And when I left high school, I left Catholicism. Because that was another lie. You know, women are such second-class citizens, and I just didn't buy into that. So I threw the baby out with the bathwater, and that was the end of my relationship with any kind of higher power. And over the years, my higher power was whatever made me feel good. I snorted lines, recreationally for a while. And after a few years, then it wasn't recreationally, it was weekends and Wednesdays. And then, it's Thursday, it's almost a weekend. Well, then pretty soon, Sunday turned into Monday, and not too long, it was every day. And then I couldn't afford it, so I had to start running for people. And after I was running for people, then I was getting some and passing it on. And you know how that goes, just to keep something in your pocket? Yeah. I was lucky. I didn't get killed. I didn't get shot. I started smoking after my nose gave me another sinus infection. I had the same doctor for like 15 years, and he knew me very well. And after about the umpteenth sinus infection, he said to me, "Sue, if you come back to me with another sinus infection like this, I won't be able to treat you because we both know what's causing it." And I just was stunned. I really thought nobody knew. So then I went home and I thought, oh my gosh, And somebody said, well, gee, you know, you can smoke it and it won't mess up your nose. Okay. Well, in the years when I just did lines, I could still make dinner and get the kids off to school and make sure I made the PTA meetings and got them to the dentist twice a year and all that stuff. But once I started smoking, it all kind of went to the wayside. I still had this delusion that life was normal and we were normal and we had a good family because I had dinner on the table at 5:30 every night. And we ate together every night as a family. And right after dinner, the kids did the dishes and the old man and I would hightail it up to the attic and or down the street or wherever, and we would be unavailable. And that was our life for quite a few years. I got busted twice, both times only for pot, fortunately, for my record at least, because they were misdemeanors at the time. I mentioned I went back to school. I got 2 degrees while I was using. A lot of term papers that got finished up at 5 in the morning with a little help from my friend. But somewhere down the road there, it just kind of turned on me. You know, I had started working when my youngest daughter went to middle school. And I couldn't make it to work on Mondays very often, or at least not early. And I was late a lot. Or too sick to get out of bed. If I didn't have a bump, I couldn't get going. I got to the point where I had only 2 states of mind, up and running or in bed sick. That's all there was. There was no in between. For about 2 years, I didn't work. And I'm an artist, and so I did side jobs and painted windows and did portraits and things like that. So I could always hustle a couple bucks here and there. And it just prolonged it because maybe if I hadn't had that to go fall back on, I would have run out of dope sooner. I would go to sleep at night, 4 or 5 in the morning, hearing the birds. My husband would be sleeping and snoring, and I hate him for being able to sleep when I couldn't. And it'd be like a zombie most of the day till I got going again. It'd be the same thing day after day after day. And I didn't know I was sick. I thought I was insane. I thought I was crazy. Finally, they used to have these ads on TV for Charter Hospital and said, Charter, if you don't get help at Charter, get help somewhere. So one day I decided I was going to go to Charter. And I didn't have the courage to just go, so I had to go down the street and get a bump from a friend. And after one big hit, I got in the car and I started driving down the alley. And here comes my 16-year-old daughter. And where are you going, Mom? I said, I'm going to Charter. She started to cry. She said, I'm going with you. And she got in the car. And they did an assessment. And they said, we can't take you because you're going to go back to the same thing you just came from and nothing's going to change. All we can do is detox you and then you'll be right back, so we can't let you come in. And I started to cry because I didn't know what else to do. And my daughter said, Mom, I got a paycheck. I'll get you a ticket to Dawn's house. Dawn was the oldest of my daughters, and she'd been living in Florida and had been clean and sober probably about 1.5 years at that point. So, okay. With the assurance that I wouldn't go home, that I would go to Florida from Charter, they let me come in. And I stayed there a few days and detoxed, and didn't learn much about addiction or anything, but I dried out a little. And then Sarah picked me up and took me to the airport, and I went to Florida. And I stayed with my daughter and her boyfriend and my two granddaughters. And I didn't use. And I started to get a life back. The weather was nice. It was wintertime. And it was nice down there. And I found a little job waitressing. Then I found another little job right around the corner at a sign shop doing some graphic work. And I had been a graphic designer earlier on, so that was nice. I was enjoying that. I even was enjoying the waitressing. And every day off, I'd take the kids and the bicycles, and we'd go down to the beach, as it was just less than a mile from where they lived to the beach. And we spent all off hours on the beach. And it was great. I loved it. I went to a psychiatrist because I knew I was crazy. I had this brain that kept telling me all this crazy stuff. And it was like 50 people lived up there, you know. I never know who was going to talk next. Yeah. And the psychiatrist taught me about codependence. And he told me I was codependent on my husband. And he suggested I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what? I'm not an alcoholic. That's my dad. Because when I had gotten into weed, I got let go of the alcohol. It didn't give me a hangover, you know? And I hadn't drank more than once or twice a year for many years, and I sure wasn't an alcoholic. But to satisfy the shrink, I went to a meeting. And there were, Southwest Florida is retired people. And at this meeting were all these ladies, probably a dozen or maybe 15 ladies, in a trailer, but they had Mercedes and all these fancy cars. And I was on a bicycle because I'd lost my license because of using. You know, if you have a bust for marijuana, you lose your license for 6 months, even if you're nowhere near a car. Yeah, well, so I wasn't driving. I hadn't driven or had a license to drive, at least, for about a year and a half at that point. So here I am on my bicycle, and all these ladies who were probably on the average 20 years older than me, and then they went around the table, and they all said they were alcoholics, and then they all talked about their problems. And one lady couldn't keep a gardener. Go figure. I just couldn't relate, you know? We were just such different worlds. So I went back to the shrink and I said, nah, I'm not an alcoholic. Because I went and it's just, I just don't relate to those women. Okay, he says. So after about 9 weeks in Florida and not using, I was feeling really healthy. I was looking healthy. Because every time I wasn't working, I was down at the beach boogie boarding and playing with the kids and riding bikes, and I was feeling wonderful. So, but my husband was home. And he'd call me, oh, come back. Finally he said, I quit. I'm not using anymore. Please come home. Well, you know what? At that point we'd been together 23 years and I loved him. It was never that I didn't. It's just that I thought if I stayed there I'd die. But if he stopped, well, gee, maybe then it's okay. So I came home. He picked me up in Chicago at the Midway Airport. And all the way home, I'm giving him this, boy, if you ever bring that stuff around me, you can just get your ass out. Real hard line. He came home on a Thursday night. We went to bed and got reacquainted. And the next day, I didn't use, and I didn't call anybody, and I didn't see anybody, and I hadn't even served supper when I said to him, gee, maybe I ought to get a little something for after supper. Duh. Yeah. So of course he did. And we did. And I was right back out there. And I used every day after that for a solid year. And I thought I would die. I had a stroke, a mini stroke. One night I went to the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and my mouth was down like this. And I was shocked because that's how my grandmother's face looked when she had her stroke. And I couldn't lift it up. So I pushed it and pushed it. Finally got it up like that. Went back and said, okay, I'm ready, give me one. I was more concerned that they wouldn't give me some than I was that I would die. My dad came to town about then for a funeral. And back up a little, at least as far as my birth family goes. I've got a younger sister and four younger brothers. And two of my brothers had gotten clean and sober with AA. My dad at that time had 26 or 20 some years in AA. And he brought two of my brothers into AA. So they were all on this AA thing. And I said to him, Dad, I can't stop. Can I come and stay with you? And he said, yeah. So he went home and he sent me a ticket. And about 3 days later, I went to Washington State, where my dad had this farm. And I went to stay with him and my mom. My mom had Alzheimer's, but she still knew who I was. And she also knew I had a problem. So she'd ask me, probably four times a day, how are your cravings, honey? Oh, man. After about two or three days of just being there and sleeping, my dad took me to an AA meeting. And I don't remember much about the meeting, but I know that the guy next to me, his name was Tim Divers, and he said to me, my wife goes to a women's meeting on Tuesday. Give me your number. I'll tell her to call you. I said, okay. Nothing else to do but sit up on the farm with Mom and Dad and feel uncomfortable watching Dad drink and listen to Mom asking me about my cravings. So this young woman came and picked me up. She had 17 years clean, and she was like 35 years old. Oh, my God. I sort of didn't believe it. But she was so happy and so beautiful, and I thought, maybe, okay. So she took me to this women's meeting. They were called Twisted Sisters. There were about nine of them there that night. And I smoked cigarettes, but my dad hated cigarettes. And that day we had been at the grocery store, and he had bought me a pack. And once he saw the price of them, they were $7 a pack then. It was in 99. And he just about went through the roof. He said, this is it. I'm not buying anymore. But make them last. So then I was really scared. I thought, oh my God, I can't even smoke. What am I going to do? So they shared around the table. And when it came to my turn, I just told them how scared I was going to flip out because I couldn't even have cigarettes. Or at least I didn't have any money for them. And my dad sure wasn't going to enable me to smoke because he hated it. And on the way home, one of the ladies who was driving me stopped at a 7-Eleven or something and gave me some money and said, go buy yourself a pack. This is from one of our sisters who doesn't smoke, but she doesn't want you to be scared. She wouldn't tell me who it was. How cool is that? And about a week later, maybe not even a week later, because I still had a few cigarettes, my husband sent me $50. So I would continue to smoke cigarettes. And the girls from Twisted Sisters, one of those women every night came up to the farm and picked me up and took me to a meeting every single night for a solid 30 days. And I didn't think I belonged there because I wasn't an alcoholic. I wore a baseball cap, and I'd pull a broom down so that I didn't have to look people in the eye. And they try to sit near the back so they wouldn't call on me, because they do the meetings a little different there. Everybody doesn't automatically speak. Most of the meetings are bigger, and they call on people. You sign in when you come in, and then the secretary calls on people based on whatever they base it on. I don't really know, but I heard things that I kind of related to, and I knew I didn't want to use anymore. I was about 3 weeks sober, I think, and I kept dreaming about using. I would wake up and I could taste it. I thought for sure I had, and then I'd look around, oh no, I'm here. Oh. And I wanted to use all the time. And I talked to my brother, and he had 10 years in AA at that point. And he said, Sue, get on your knees and ask God to take those, take that cravings, to take the dreams. And I laughed at him. I said, come on, it's the last time you saw this woman in church. And he said to me, what have you got to lose? So the conversation went, I don't know where, but through the day, I thought about that a number of times. What have you got to lose? I'd already lost my home, my family, my life. I was 53 years old, and I was living with my parents, and penniless and jobless, and couldn't see any immediate prospects for anything, except I had about 20, 21 days without using, which was the longest I'd had in a couple of years. And so that night, I decided to try it. What do I have to lose, right? So I said this prayer, and it probably went like, okay, God, if you're up there or out there, take away the dreams or the cravings if you can. Amen. And I said it out loud, and I meant it, but I didn't believe it, you know? And that night I had the same damn dream I've been having every night, where everybody's sitting around my kitchen table and they're passing the plate and they're passing the pipe, and they threw this golf ball size rock down in front of me. And instead of grabbing it and hitting it, and I smashed it and I blew it, and this big white cloud went up, and everybody started yelling, hey, what are you doing? Oh my God. They were freaking out. And I started yelling at them, get out of my life. Get out of my kitchen. Get out of my house. Get out of my life. And I talk in my sleep, and I was yelling. I woke myself up. And the first thought I had was, oh, good. My unconscious finally gets it that I don't want to use anymore. That's what I thought. Well, I didn't have another dream, another using dream, or a craving for a solid year. From that day till I was sober over a year, I did not have one using dream. I didn't have one physical craving. Who gets that? Oh my God. And I always figure this stuff out. Like in retrospect, like when I'm 6 months clean, I look back and say, oh, I haven't had a using dream. Oh, I haven't had a craving. And at a year, I realized it was God. It wasn't me. Because on my own, I'm using anything and everything that comes along. That's just who I am. I stayed in Washington, went to meetings for 6 weeks maybe, and then I went to Florida. I came home to Milwaukee for one day in between, and I got rid of my cold clothes because it's always kind of cold and rainy in Washington, and it was spring, and I picked up summer clothes, and I was home for about 8 hours between flights, and my husband was still using, and I told him, I love you, and I can't stay here, I'll die. I knew if I stayed there, I would die. Because if I started again, I couldn't stop. And you get to a certain age, and it's just, I don't know too many addicts my age that are still breathing unless they're clean. So anyhow, I left. Went back to Florida, and I stayed down there 5 months. And a few weeks after I was down there, I got this letter from my husband that said, I went to a meeting. And I thought, oh yeah, right. I've heard that before. A week or two later, I get another letter. I got a sponsor. I'm working step one. What are you doing?
Whoa.
Cool. Yeah. So then we're writing back and forth because we didn't have a phone. My daughter didn't have a phone at that time. And I was in no hurry to get one because I didn't want to be bugged to come home because I was quite happy there. And I was going to meetings there. And at that point, I thought, I better get on the stick. So I found a sponsor. And we worked the steps. The first step, which I'd been living in, 2 and 3. And by that time, I knew enough about there being something bigger than me. I didn't connect it to being God. I didn't at all. I thought it was just like, you come to these rooms and you sit at these tables and you talk to people and they accept you for exactly who you are, without reservation. They even love you. And there's power in that. And we're all trying to stay clean. And there's power in that, you know? That was my higher power. You guys were my first higher power. And then somebody gave me this image or allegory, I guess, said I could imagine myself as a drop of water, and I'm always going to be water, and that's who I am, and that I can be in a stream running down the mountainside into the ocean, or I can get evaporated up into a cloud and come down as a snowflake or as sleet or whatever, and always going back to the source. And if that's who I am, then this whole source, you could call that God. And I could see that. I could get that. So that was my higher power for a while. Then I had somebody who told me a story about the addicts driving on the bus down Highway 1 in California, and that's got real sharp drop-offs to the sea at a bunch of places, and it's kind of windy, and they said, imagine you're on that bus and there's 40 addicts riding along with you, and of course we want what we want. When we want it, we're addicts. That's how our brains work. So the first curve, I'm grabbing the steering wheel and somebody else is grabbing the brake. Well, it's inevitable where the bus goes. And then I was told to just sit back and let God drive the bus. So for a lot of my early prayer life, I'd get up in the morning and say, okay, God, drive the bus. And it worked for me. My concept of a higher power of God has changed, has grown. It's come to this place where I truly know that there is something bigger than me, and it's about love, and it's here, and it's real, and I can draw on that power anytime I ask. It's not just here, but it's there and there and there. It's in each of us, and especially in us, because we're already chosen people. We're already living miracles, every one of us. Most people die from this disease. When I was at Charter, they told me 3% of cocaine addicts recover. 3%? Well, here's a room full of 3%ers. You know, if you can't feel some gratitude and love from that, I don't know. It's there. And I can draw from all of you as well as my higher power. So I come back to Milwaukee and I start going to CA meetings. I never heard of CA, but boy, was I home. You guys know how to party. You guys have fun. AA didn't really give me that. But boy, you guys, you know how to put it on. We get together and it's always fun. I've never had a bad time at a CA function. You know, I got a sponsor when I got back to Milwaukee. And she was a big book Nazi alcoholic. She didn't even use cocaine. Excuse me. But she pounded that book into me, first by spoonfuls, and sometimes by handfuls. And sometimes she'd say, read page such and such and paragraph two and call me back, click. Okay. But what I've discovered through learning about that is that the answers to my life are in that book. In the first 164 pages, there's a design for life. And if I pay attention to it and follow the suggestions, my life works. Not always exactly how I want it, but guess what? I don't always get what I want. I can want what I want, but I don't always get it. But I absolutely get everything I need. And that's from working these steps, from living these steps, from my higher power. And today I can call God. I love this program for teaching me that. I love this program for teaching me to see God in every human being I meet, in every living thing, even every rock. There's God everywhere. Just gotta open your eyes and look, it's there. And the beautiful thing is, we get together here and it just shines. You guys are a bonfire. I was so lucky. A number of women have asked me to sponsor them over the years. And I've tried my best to be as big a Big Book Nazi as my sponsor was for me. Because the answers that I found there, they can find there too. And they do find there too. And I'm privileged to have worked with women who now have 7 years, 9 years, 8 years. One has 10, and they have sponsees, and their sponsees have 2 years, 3 years. Wow. It's amazing. And the beautiful thing is, every time I start with a sponsee, I get to work these steps again from scratch. I get to renew my own perspective, and it changes. I'm not the same person I was 14 years ago, or even 10 years ago, or 2 years ago. I'm still growing. God ain't done with me yet. I'm still learning. I learn from each and every one of you. Every meeting I go to, I've never been to a meeting where I don't hear something I need to hear. Never. The answers in these steps, in these meetings, and in this fellowship, you people are my family. I'm so grateful to all of you for helping me get to today. Yesterday I celebrated 14 years clean. Thank you. But it wasn't me, it was you guys and God. And just doing the next little right thing and not worrying about the rest. There's no coincidences in my life. I've come to realize everything has a reason and an order. I just don't get the itinerary. But there's a reason for it. It's just God's business and not mine. The only thing that I have to pay attention to is this tiny little thing in front of me right now. What's my next right thing? That's all I got to worry about. God will take care of tomorrow. If I keep doing what I'm doing today. I want to thank you guys for coming out, eating chili, listening to my spiel, and loving me, because I love you guys too. That's all I got.
What am I supposed to do with this?
We have a gift for you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Oh, flowers. Thank you.